You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Richard Nixon resigned 40 years ago this coming Saturday on August 9, 1974. 2 years later, Ronald Reagan challenged Gerald Ford for the Republican nomination. Most Americans are too young to have a clear memory of this or any other 1970s events like gas lines, disco, stagflation, or President Ford telling New York City to drop dead. At least that's what the front page of the Daily News claimed he said in 1975. Out of it all, Ronald Reagan emerged as the political victor of the 1970s. In his new book, The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan, Rick Perlstein continues his historical survey of the ascent of conservative politics in the United States. It's published by Scribner's. And I'm very pleased that it brings Rick Perlstein back to our show today. Welcome back.
It's an honor to be here.
Your book is generating some heated debate. Do you think that you've hit a nerve with this book?
I know I've hit a nerve. in the preface, I tell the story of how Ronald Reagan was just kind of like this profoundly dividing figure ever since high school. I discovered this cartoon in his high school yearbook. You remember that he was a lifeguard, right, in Dixon, Illinois, in the Rock River. And the cartoon had a drowning man and the heroic Ronald Reagan leaping in to save him. And the guy says, "Don't save me, I'm trying to commit suicide." And Reagan is depicted saying, "You're going to have to postpone that because I want to win a medal."
Oh.
Right? So this is very much kind of the Ronald Reagan that we talk about on the left, that he's this kind of phony, right? This kind of fake bravura.
But he has the nice nickname. Richard Nixon has the tricky Dick
right.
name. His nickname is Dutch.
Right. It was probably one that he gave himself. Like a lot of stories about Ronald Reagan that he told, there are kind of three different versions, and they, you know, kind of contradict each other. He thought it was more manly than Ronald. And when he got to Hollywood, they thought it was too silly. So when his friends from back in Iowa, where he was a radio personality, saw Ronald Reagan was in this movie, they didn't know who he was. He had given himself Dutch and made it stick.
I misspoke. The book is published by Simon & Schuster, not by Scribner. Paul Krugman weighed in yesterday about the heated debate under the headline "Sliming Rick Perlstein." What else have you seen in response to some of the charges that have been made against you?
There was an astonishingly thoughtful article in Salon magazine today by a writer named David Dayen, D-A-Y-E-N. There's something from Media Matters that I think the headline is something like, Ann Coulter's publicist attacks Rick Perlstein. This guy, Craig Shirley, who's a pretty good historian. I like to say he wants my book pulped. He's trying to sue me for $25 million and getting the books destroyed.
His book is Reagan's Revolution.
Yeah, I want his book read because it's pretty good. It has flaws, but all history books have flaws.
They say your books have flaws, too.
They do. They do. Another really good piece was in Reason magazine, which is a libertarian magazine where they're huge fans of Ronald Reagan. That was by a writer named Jesse Walker. You know, I'd refer people to those, and I think people will see that the charges are, as the New York Times once called a certain word, a 8-letter barnyard epithet.
Tapes of Nixon discussing his downfall will be steadily released in the coming days because of the 40th yeah. anniversary of his resignation. Have they all been transcribed by now?
Yes, actually, there's a book that just came out by Douglas Brinkley, the historian.
We had his co-author on Nichter, our show last
yeah.
week.
And I think they're pretty much, they're all transcribed. I'm not sure if they're all published in book form. But all the Watergate versions of the tapes were transcribed, of course, by John Dean, who has a fabulous book out this week.
He was here as well.
Yeah. And what he really does is kind of tell the whole story of Watergate from inside the Oval Office. I kind of tell it from the perspective of what it was like to be a citizen and watch this thing unfold.
So we're getting a rounder sense of who Richard Nixon was.
I think it's pretty much the same sense.
Edmund Morris found Ronald Reagan so puzzling that he took a quasi-fictional approach in his biography of him. How difficult are you finding Reagan as a historical subject?
You know, I didn't really get that. I didn't really kind of understand where Edmund Morris was coming from. I think that if you approach Ronald Reagan from the perspective of what is kind of known in the sort of psychological world as an adult child of an alcoholic, he makes a little more sense. He had this incredibly chaotic childhood. His dad was a drunk, to use kind of the blunt word. Kept on changing jobs. He lived in like 20 different rented homes before the age of 18. He never knew if his dad would be in the newspaper the next day for breaking prohibition, right? Although he wasn't, and I'm convinced maybe that it was because in Dixon, Illinois, he was a pinnacle partner of the local constabulary. His mom was kind of a inveterate do-gooder. And one of the things she would do was she would entertain and read the Bible to prisoners. And prisoners would be released to her custody and stay in the family's sewing room. And when that happened, Ronald Reagan and his son Neil would kind of sleep two to a bed. You have this very weird, kind of strange household, very unpredictable. And I think to understand Reagan's kind of act of self-formation, you have to understand how he kind of created this mythologizing narrative for himself.
But it's not surprising he started off as a Democrat.
His dad was a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat in a very conservative part of the country. The Dixon Telegraph, when I read in the 1920s, it was deeply reactionary, very angry stuff about, you know, Robert La Follette and things like that. And, of course, it's well known that his dad's kind of economic fortunes were saved by becoming a New Deal administrator in their town.
You began your series of books with Barry Goldwater, continued with Nixon, and now you take us from Nixon to Reagan. Has the rise of conservatism been personality-driven?
No, I don't think so. I have a very specific method of writing history. I use biography as kind of like a whetstone to kind of sharpen my sense of the actual electorate. Right. Why do we choose these people? And by we, I mean kind of the majority. Why do these people emerge? And do you remember James McGregor Burns, mm-hmm. the famous political theorist who died just a couple of weeks ago? He has a book called Leadership. And I read this kind of after I'd already kind of come up with my method. But he speaks fairly eloquently about how real transformational leaders come about when kind of the unconscious drives of the leader kind of match the collective unconscious drives of the country.
So someone like Michael Dukakis wouldn't have been able to connect to that?
Michael Dukakis kind of swung and missed on that one. But Ronald Reagan coming out of this very chaotic childhood and really kind of being able to project this stout certainty in the midst of kind of moral chaos really spoke to the needs of the American electorate coming out of the 1970s, which was a chaotic time full of moral confusion.
My guest is Rick Perlstein. His latest book, The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan. You say that Americans have been divided into two tribes. Were divided into two tribes. Are we still?
Oh, we are.
The same ones?
Yes, I think that kind of the spiritual children of the Confederacy and the spiritual children of kind of the commercial cosmopolitan world of the industrial North. I think if you look at maps who spanks their children, you know, who is in favor of the death penalty, all sorts of policy prescriptions, they actually look like maps of the United States during the Civil War.
One of the tribes, you say, has a desire for innocence. Where does that come from?
I think that the American nation is founded on several originary wounds, most profound of which is slavery and the ordeal of race in America. And the fact of the matter is that our country was built economically on the backs of bond labor. You know, chattel slavery. And it almost immediately after the Civil War, there was this profound attempt to kind of repress this kind of wound. I quote it in the first couple paragraphs of the book. The New York Times says, well, we shouldn't worry about those suspicious circles who still think the South is a national problem. Of course, the South was forming this new form of slavery, you know. And the suspicious circles were the people who said, no, we have to get beyond this kind of denial, and we have to reckon with the wounds of our past. And in the book, I really show that happening in a pretty exciting and interesting way in the years of Watergate, in the years of the Church Committee, in the years of the first oil crisis. We really see kind of deep in the level of even popular culture, things like MASH, where the good guys are the people who are anti-war and the bad guys are the John Wayne patriots, and things like wacky packages, these stickers that kids would put on their lunchboxes that kind of depicted consumer capitalism as phony. We saw this kind of hard look at the verities and pieties of our society. And what Ronald Reagan kind of was all about was giving people kind of absolution from that.
How did Goldwater or Nixon fit into the politics of division, of dividing the country into these two feuding factions and playing one off
right.
against the other?
So I have these three books, right? The first one was called Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater and the Unmaking of the American Consensus, and it covers the years from 1958 to 1964. And kind of his brand of conservatism really was kind of based on this ideal of the businessman's republic, right? That kind of the merchants who succeed in the free market are kind of the moral guardians of society. And so it's almost like a kind of more kind of a division that kind of is about sort of class conflict, right? Nixon, in my second book, Nixonland, is about kind of the psychological resentments of what Nixon called the silent majority. Right, those stout patriotic people who don't protest, and the people who did or didn't think of themselves as their moral betters. Reagan comes in, and the biggest division he kind of marks is that between people who kind of believe that America can do no wrong, and people who believe that the higher form of patriotism is criticizing the country to make it better.
He was promoting suspicion of U.S. government.
Reagan was.
Yes.
Yes, that's right.
Which neither Nixon nor Goldwater had done.
Oh, Goldwater was profoundly suspicious of government. Conscience of a conservative says, my goal is not to pass laws but to repeal them. Nixon's a more complicated figure, but if you look at what he had in mind for his second term by reading his memoir and looking at his first budget, he was much more conservative than people remember, because he kind of couldn't do what he wanted to do because of Watergate.
With all the news about spying by the Bush and Obama administrations, are we entering a new phase of suspicion?
I think that we are blanching from that imperative. I mean, look at the way kind of Edward Snowden has kind of been baited. You know, he's this crazy, neurotic guy that we shouldn't be listening to. He's running and hiding in Russia, right? And, you know, when the
kid who didn't go to college.
Yeah, he didn't go to college. He must not be very smart. Maybe he's a spy, you know? So we have, and, you know, the galleys in my book had a quote from Barack Obama on them, kind of looked like Barack Obama had blurred my book. He didn't, for the record. But it was a quote of him saying, America is the greatest nation in the world, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those kind of protestations are kind of de rigueur for our politics now. And in a way, my book is a history of how that came to be.
From 1972 through 2000, turnout in presidential elections has usually been below 55%. Do you see
That's
any
right.
possible connection between the America the Innocent theme and a low voter turnout?
That's a really interesting question. I think that the period I'm writing about in the 70s is one in which voter apathy was skyrocketing. Even in these very contested Republican and Democratic primaries, no one was voting. Christopher Lydon, you know, who was a New York Times reporter then, and he's going to be interviewing me in Boston at the JFK Library, wrote this great piece about that. And what does this mean for the body politic? The fact of the matter is, part of the conservative argument is kind of robbing the postman and then complaining when the mail doesn't get delivered.
But, of course, there have been divisive things on the other side as well. Mm-hmm. One of the most famous and divisive campaign ads of all time, the Daisy ad
That's
of
right.
1964, was created by liberals.
That's right. Yes. And I think that when you begin to see kind of politics as in apocalyptic terms, you know, as kind of battles between the forces of light and the forces of darkness. Yeah, that's when you really begin to see viciousness, because, you know, anything is justified in order to win. And Barry Goldwater was just seen as so wicked so evil, so vicious that anything was licensed. And you can kind of see that in the the records, the Lyndon Johnson administration that I studied. You know, we're gonna pursue, here's one memo, the kids born with two heads theme. You know, if you vote for Barry Goldwater, there'll be nuclear fallout and kids will be born with two heads.
Well, nowadays, of course, it's the other way around. Republicans
That's right.
are calling liberals evil.
That's right.
They are responsible for everything that's wrong in the world.
Yeah, and Barack Obama wants us all to sing Kumbaya while he gets, you know, sort of steamrolled.
Rick Perlstein's latest book is The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reason. It's published by Simon & Schuster.
You said The Rise of Reagan. Reason.
Reagan, wow. Okay, well, I've been misspeaking a lot
recently. Some
people
say The Fall of Reason, but I'm not going to say that.
We will continue this conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Rick Perlstein. His latest book, The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan, published by Simon & Schuster. Was Reagan especially well-matched for the America the Innocent tribe?
I think that he was kind of the wave that kind of brought in the tide. I mean, he really was all about the song of innocence, but not the song of experience.
You described times when journalists would question him on something that, and he would launch into an anecdote, and then the reporters would just drop the line of questioning.
Yeah.
Did he intentionally play the role of the innocent?
He was a pretty guileless guy in many respects.
Because in the mid-1980s, the comedian Phil Hartman did a Saturday Night Live skit of a very smart
right.
Reagan playing a fool in public.
Right. That wasn't the case. I mean, he did have a cerebral and intellectual side, and I know a lot of people would protest that idea. But he was a pretty inveterate reader when it came to things that kind of fit his mindset. But no, I think that what was so remarkable about him was his ability to kind of project utter confidence in kind of what he felt in his heart. When other people felt, you know, kind of contradiction and confusion, he would just project this clarity and this calm. And this is what I think he kind of taught himself to do as a child.
If not for Reagan, might Nixon, Vietnam, and Watergate have brought the conservative ascent to an end? Or was the United States bound to get more conservative?
No, actually, I'm beginning research on my next book, which is going to cover the years from kind of 77 through 80. And a lot of the conservatives were not behind Reagan. They were behind this guy, Phil Crane, who went nowhere, John Connolly, George Bush. Really, the forces in the Republican Party were all leaning towards conservatism, and they were all kind of pushing pretty conservative ideas.
Do you think the U.S. has always been a right-leaning country?
No. I mean, I think that the generation that kind of gave us the first mass middle class did so by pursuing quite liberal policies, social democracy.
Well, during the 60s and into the 70s, it was predicted that the anti-war movement would lead to a permanent leftist bias
Absolutely.
Among a huge chunk of the population. That didn't happen, and we wound up seeing Bob Dylan go conservative at one point.
Yes, and Stokely Carmichael, who became an evangelical, and actually that was Eldridge Cleaver. It's hard mm-hmm. hard to keep track, and of course Jerry Rubin became a Wall Street guy. One of the themes of my book is, you know, how bad at predicting things journalists and pundits are. And one of the things they do is, you know, it's the bias of all people who would predict the future. They project current trends into the future. And
a lot of wishful thinking,
A lot of wishful thinking. I think that the basic kind of journalistic tradition often honored in The Breach is an Enlightenment one. And the Enlightenment tradition deeply believes in the kind of onward march of reason. You know, religion is going to wither away. You know, my books are full of examples of pundits, you know, in 1964 saying Lyndon Johnson's victory proves that conservatism is dead. I found Joseph Kraft, a pundit in 1974, saying that the primary results in 1974 in California proved that Reaganism is dead in California. You saw it a couple months ago when the argument was that the Tea Party was on the ropes because the Republican establishment was coming back. And lo and behold, Eric Cantor is kicked out in his butt.
Can we be seeing another change now? Is the free enterprise convictions of the Reagan era are undermined by the failure of trickle-down and Reaganomics? Or are we still, as we see in some states, Reaganomics in Kansas, Reaganomics is and trickle-down are still a belief system that are in force?
Yeah, you can't beat something with nothing in politics. And the problem is, you know, the Democratic Party has become so enthralled to kind of the money class and the hedge fund types that you got, you know, kind of the same people who got into this, got us into this mess in the first place, you know, never really kind of being reproached by the Democratic Party. So, I mean, it's really is, you know, kind of, is the Democratic Party going to go the Elizabeth Warren way, or is it going to go the Hillary Clinton way? And, you know, Hillary Clinton has already kind of reached out to the bankers and said, you know, you don't really have much to worry about from me.
Your first book in the series was Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater and the Unmaking of the American Consensus. How much consensus was there in the United States in the 1960s?
Yeah, the title's a little bit ironic, right? I think if I were, you know, kind of heading it to do it over again, it's not quite as graceful, but I might put quotation marks around it. I mean, in the book and in all my work, I always see kind of protestations of consensus in American life as epiphenomenal. You know, kind of like an attempt to repress or paper over seams that always kind of burst forth in times of tension.
Can modern conservatism be traced back to Goldwater or earlier to opposition to FDR's New
Deal?
Yeah,
I think it really does trace back.
Well, even the Civil War, as you suggest here.
Right, or the Constitutional Convention, in which kind of like the slave states kind of, in order to stay into the Republic, got their free two senators, you know, and the compromises like that. Definitely, all the kind of arguments are there in the kind of things you see businessmen saying amongst themselves in the 1920s. But that was discredited in the Depression. And after World War II, the Republican Party turned left, much like the Democratic Party turned right. And Eisenhower said anyone who challenges Social Security will destroy the Republican Party. So it really kind of took some force of will. Some circumstances like the rise of the civil rights movement to kind of bring these ideas back into the mainstream.
There were Democrats who felt that the challenge to Social Security during the Bush years and more recently by people like Paul Ryan would have a terrible impact on the Republican Party, but doesn't seem to have had that effect. I mean, it's been beaten down, but it doesn't seem to have entered many people's consciousness.
Yes, and I think that there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that they have been turned back in their attempts to privatize Social Security, so kind of the proof is in the pudding. But the other is that they become very skilled, and this is where people like Frank Luntz come in and Karl Rove, at assuaging the public through language that kind of masks their true intention.
Although it's also been reported that Bill Clinton was seriously considering privatization of Social Security when the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke.
So there you go. That's a good reason. How can we criticize the Republican Party for challenging Social Security when we have Barack Obama saying he's considering chain CPI, which is a cut in Social Security? Like I say, you can't beat something with nothing in politics.
My guest is Rick Perlstein, P-E-R-L-S-T-E-I-N. His latest book, The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan, published by Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The 1960s have a kind of iconic place in American history. The average American is old enough to personally remember the 1980s, but you're writing about the 70s here. Is that the forgotten decade for many Americans, or maybe a decade we'd like to forget?
Yeah, it kind of is. All the professors who wrote the first histories of the 70s kind of announced that in the title of their books. One of the first scholarly books about the 1970s was It Seemed Like Nothing Happened. And it was ironic, you know, of course, lots of things happened. But, you know, the 60s were so dense with incidents and change. It seemed like every month brought a new revolution.
Of course, the 60s bled into the 1970s. Yes. We call half of the 1970s the 60s.
Right. But here, to me, is the greatest seam between what we think of as the 60s and we think of as the 70s. It's not what happened in popular culture. It's not even what happened in electoral politics. It's what happened in economics. 1973 is when you first start seeing the flatlining of the incomes of average Americans. So the 60s really is this age of great dreams, this post-war economic boom where not only does Abbie Hoffman think he can levitate the Pentagon, you know, Walt Rostow thinks he can rewire South Vietnam, and Lyndon Johnson thinks like he can cure cancer. It seems harder to do that in the 1970s when that sort of economic confidence is in retreat.
With your study of so much news coverage from the 70s, do you think that it was just American politics that saw a transition, or was there a deeper transition in the American people?
Was there a deeper transition in the American people? Well, I think a lot of people in the 60s, again, felt this kind of flush of possibility and confidence in the 1960s, whether it was radicalism or liberalism or even folks who were just living in the suburbs. I think that once you kind of remove that flush of confidence, you get a different sort of politics.
Well, there's also economic change in the 70s, besides stagflation, that Republicans and especially Ronald Reagan were able to capitalize on.
Absolutely. When Ronald Reagan is running for re-election in 1984, he calls Walter Mondale, because he was the vice president under Carter, Vice President Malaise, right? This idea that the Democrats are the people who brought you kind of economic privation, which was a serious, serious and historic reversal of the traditional poles of the American political debate. The Republicans were seen as the ones who are going to make you poor and kick you out of the middle class. Once the Democrats were able to make a credible argument that it was these Democrats who had done it, you know, even though I think you can trace it, the fault to the policies of Richard Nixon, then you really begin to get a different ballgame.
You write, by the middle of the 1970s, the perception of horrors was worse. What do you mean by that?
The perception of horrors. Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, one of the reviewers made the point that, you know, I'm kind of piling up all these horrible things that were in the newspapers and that people were perceiving. And he asked, well, are there really more things like, you know, killer bees, you know, or these you know, algae blooms.
Yeah, Son of Sam.
Right, the Son of Sam. And, you know, I think if you could possibly, you know, objectively measure how much horror there is in the air, it probably would be equal. But the idea that I'm kind of getting across is people's imagination of apocalypse was just so much richer. People were looking for the idea that the world was going to end.
As the Nixon administration collapsed, did the Republicans have a strategy for recovery?
Not much. I tell a story of, the voter identification of the Republican Party was 18%. And I tell the story of the Republican National Committee running these television specials that were supposed to be fundraising specials called Republicans Are People Too. That's how low the confidence of the party was. And the first one ran, and then the second one ran, and the second one only raised from their televised pitch $5,000. So they just canceled the third one. And really the only kind of idea they had, well, the Minnesota Republican Party changed its name, you know. Of course, the liberals, Republicans said it was conservatism that was doing them in. The conservatives said it was liberalism. And without kind of a strong, charismatic leader, and Gerald Ford was not it, the Republican Party would have had a difficult time coming back.
Before he became president, did Reagan ever face any charges of moral failing or even misconduct? He was called a Teflon president, but wasn't he the only divorced president? And wasn't there an issue with his taxes?
Yes.
That it hurt others.
The business of being divorced, that really didn't kind of rise to the level of much public controversy. Privately, he would talk about how many women he slept with, the real moral turpitude that was on his record was not paying any state income taxes in 1971. And the New York Times did an investigation and discovered that he was basically participating in this utterly unethical tax dodge. He was, quote-unquote, buying cattle, and he called himself a rancher. But again, he was a Teflon guy then. It just did not stick. And liberals were astonished that this didn't set him on his heels. But he was so good at kind of projecting this innocence.
Goldwater, Nixon and Reagan had all embraced law and order themes in the 60s. How did Reagan spin the record as news of the Nixon administration's Watergate crimes emerged?
it's really remarkable. I think this is one of my most surprising, personally, one of my most surprising findings in my research for the book was how Ronald Reagan handled Watergate. He just consistently said it didn't matter. It wasn't a big deal.
He agreed with Nixon that when the president does it, that means it's not illegal? Is that what happened with Iran-Contra as well?
He just kind of wrote it off to typical election year shenanigans and said the Democrats were worse and said that, you know, if we could just know how many, you know, dead people were voting in Chicago, we'd be horrified. And he just divided the world into good guys and bad guys, and he believed Nixon was a good guy. And he just kind of – and by the way, the pundits, when they heard him say this, they're like, what's this guy doing? He cannot possibly advance in politics without kind of repudiating Nixon. But what my argument is, and what kind of observers at the time didn't understand, was he was speaking to an American longing that the problems could just go away.
Throughout all of your books, you reveal how the pundits almost always get it wrong.
It's getting kind of tired.
And yet they wind up keeping their jobs.
Yeah, the guys who said that the Iraqi people were going to greet us as liberators, they're back on TV.
A number of President Ford's comments, he was president during the time you're writing about, could have been said today. For example, he said, some people question their government's ability to make hard decisions and stick with them. They expect Washington politics as usual. I guess every president has felt frustrated in that way.
Yeah, I think that's kind of a typical kind of boilerplate cliche of, you know, speaking to people's frustration with politics and government. No one really brought it to the level of eloquence that Reagan did.
These days, might the United States be divided into more than two tribes? Are conservatives now splitting, Tea Party conservatives versus the conventional Reagan-style Republicans? That might include John Boehner and John McCain and Mitch McConnell.
Well, don't forget that John Boehner, shortly after the rise of the Tea Party, said that there was a millimeter's worth of light between him and the Tea Party. I think that conservatism in America has had a pretty strong organic unity. Of course, there's going to be differences. Of course,
the Republican Party is the party of business and also the party of anti-business these days.
I think that the grassroots of the Republican Party often expresses frustration at business, but it's often because business dares cooperate with government.
Rick Perlstein's book, The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan, is published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
That was great. It went by fast. It's a pleasure.